Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview about access to home health care for disabled individuals. Then, for our piece segment, we discuss a rally this Sunday in Albany to support Cuba. We then hear about another Sunday rally over in Schenectady about the merger of two hospitals over there. We follow that with Willie Terry talking with Troy Snug about ending gun violence. And then finally, we hear from Jada Robinson, a young Black female fighter, about her return to the Junior Olympics. But first, headlines.
The Times Union reports that the Saratoga Springs City Council meeting fell into chaos Tuesday night with shouting, name-calling, threats of arrest, and demands for resignations. The packed meeting was jammed with Black Lives Matter advocates who demanded that the city change their attitudes and actions towards people of color. Dozens of residents voiced their anger over the police department's use of riot gear, horses, and armored tanks to patrol the Black Lives Matter march on July 14th, a protest that ended in five arrests.
Kristen Dart, a member of the Saratoga Springs Police Reform Task Force, criticized the council for its stance on police reform issues, stating that it has either been silent or vocally reinforced the idea that if Black folks aren't asking for justice with politeness and smiles, then they are violent gangbangers who don't care about the city.
Global Foundries plans to build a second semiconductor fabrication plant at its Fab 8 campus in Malta. An expansion of the company says it will lead to the creation of another 1,000 jobs and double its manufacturing capacity. The company presently employs 3,000 workers.
The record reports that plans by the city of Cohoes to generate clean energy by installing 8,000 floating solar panels on its water reservoir recently gained key support with the approval by the United States House Committee on Appropriations of legislation that contains $3 million in funding for the National Demonstration Project. The project would demonstrate by providing grants to municipalities as an alternative option to current tax credit for private investments for floating solar installations would incentivize municipalities to invest in their own energy infrastructure in a sustainable way.
Albany County confirmed a COVID-19 death on Tuesday. The death marks a total of 388 in the country from COVID since March 2020. The death comes as the Capital Region has seen a recent rise in cases and hospitalizations. Albany County's most recent seven-day average percent positive rate is up to 1.6%, while the Capital Region remains at 1.7%.
Wildfires in the American West, including one burning in Oregon that's currently the largest in the United States, are creating hazy skies as far away as New York and the Capital District, as the massive infernos spew smoke and ash into the air in columns up to 6 miles high. That's it for headlines.
So for our first segment, disability rights groups are upset that Governor Cuomo and the state legislature failed to pass legislation that would repeal restrictions to home care access, especially during COVID. Mike Volkman discusses the challenges that the disability community faces in receiving adequate assistance with Mark Dunley.
We're joined today by Michael Volkman, who is a disability activist with ADAPT New York Capital Region, is also a frequent op-ed contributor to the Albany Times Union. And disabled activists across the state are quite annoyed with the state's refusal to pass bills particularly Assembly Bill 5367, to repeal deadly restrictions to home care access, particularly amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. But, you know, Michael, why don't you just, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of the problems that, you know, disabled individuals are facing in terms of trying to get their particularly home care needs met?
Okay, now when it comes to home care, this is something that we need for our freedom and our independence, and this is not negotiable. And the governor is trying to do a lot of things to destroy, or at least limit, the use of consumer directed for reasons that only he knows, but. It puts disabled New Yorkers in a position of a clear and present danger that somebody else is trying to take control of who comes into our homes and touches our bodies and isn't willing to pay them a decent living wage to feed their children and pay their rent. So we are now facing a situation where not enough people are even willing to do this job. And so we are running short on our ability to recruit and train and hire new personal assistants. And they're not sticking around to keep doing the job.
Now, you know, of course, providing, you know, personal assistance, you know, is in reality a pretty, you know, challenging job. And when, you know, on one hand, it's good that the state has raised its minimum wage and fast food workers are getting, you know, a higher wage, but without, you know, a corresponding increase in the wages that home care workers could get, I guess many of them decide to take an easier job.
Yeah, well, a lot of the systems in America and around the world are run by people who are not disabled, and since they don't experience what it's like to live with a disability, they take what they know from consultants who study us, so they don't really know what they are doing. So they think that being disabled and having workers come into your home, that's not a big deal, and what they pay is not based on the reality of what we need. We need reliable, dependable people who can follow directions, who we can trust, and that's not as easy to come by as the typical government worker understands. So when they ignore increasing budget for something like this, they don't think that they are doing any harm, but from our perspective, that is extremely harmful.
Now, you know, we mentioned these bills that you were trying, or, you know, yep, the community was trying to get passed. What were some of the changes that you're, you know, hoping to see?
Well, we just want the bills that are being introduced from the governor's office and from the health department. There are policies from the governor and the health department that are very increasingly restrictive, tightening eligibility rates for who can be eligible for home services. And the people who need it are going to need it regardless of what the governor says. So the bills are inclined to stop that kind of hostile policy from happening so that we won't have these restrictions anymore. The legislature is helping us to stop our oppression.
You know, obviously, unfortunately, the way decisions are often made at the state legislature, you know, relates to, you know, the size of the campaign contributions that are being made and the high-priced lobbyists that are employed. I assume the disability community is somewhat at a disadvantage in terms of that particular approach to legislation.
Yeah, you know, the industries that exploit us for profit, they have lobbyists, and a lot of the corporations in the industry are receiving their revenue from Medicaid, because many of their quote unquote residents are on Medicaid, and they're just sucking up the funding from Medicaid, and they have a statewide and nationwide associations that pay the lobbyists to go and lie about the disabled people living in the nursing homes and other institutions, and lying about the assumption that we really need to be in nursing homes. That is false. No, we don't. We can live independently, and I'm living proof my physical disability might be considered severe, and I have lived independently since I went away from my parents to go to college on September 11th, 1983. So anybody who says people like me need to be in a nursing home, that is a lie. And nursing homes cost as much as four times more than community-based in-home personal assistance. So even though the nursing homes say the community-based services are expensive, they are deceiving, because what the nursing homes cost for each individual and in the aggregate is up to four times as much. So any state where there is limited or even no personal assistance services, the taxpayers are getting ripped off.
So, you know, what can the average person do at this point to, I guess, both push Cuomo on this particular legislation, Cuomo and the legislature, and otherwise be of assistance to, you know, the rights of the disability community?
Everybody should take it personally. Now, when we talk about disabled people, most people in this world are not disabled. So when we say the disabled, they're thinking about it somebody else. I want you to take this to heart, because if you feel that you do not have a disability today, every person in this universe has the potential of acquiring a disability. So if you think I'm talking about somebody else, no, I'm talking about you too, because anytime something could happen, you can be feeling a little different. You go to the doctor and he tells you you have fill in the blank, or maybe you slip on a patch of ice and slam into a tree, and suddenly you have a disability. You never planned for this. You never expected this, but now your life has changed, and it's going to be shocking. You'll probably go through the stages of grief, and which would take some time, but you can adjust to it, you can get used to it, and then you have to learn how to do the things that you do in a different way. And once you get through this transition, which can take several years, then you can continue with your life and feel okay and feel good about yourself. But there are these external forces, such as a state health department and the services that you need to get on with your life. And when people like the health department put obstacles in your way, that's going to be a problem, and you have to spend the rest of your life getting in the habit of advocating for yourself.
Well, Mike Volkman, we want to thank you today for joining us here. Among other things, you're active with ADAPT in New York Capital Region. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So we do expect to see some of the disability community, doing some more active protests in the coming week or so. And we'll remind people that the American with Disability Act, known as the ADA, was signed into law on July 26, 1990.
And on Sunday, July 25th, a rally in support of Cuba will be held in Townsend Park in Albany at 2 p.m. Kenyon Ryan discusses why the rally is being held with Mark.
For our Peace Bucket, we're joined by Kenyon Ryan, who's involved with, among other things, the Capital District Socialist Party. On Sunday, July 25th at 2 p.m., they and a bunch of other groups are helping to sponsor a rally in solidarity with the people of Cuba and the present situation down there. Kenyon, can you maybe talk a little about what's going to take place at the rally and why it's being called?
Certainly, and thank you for having me. So the rally was called because there have been a lot of protests in Cuba and it's made national news. And I wanted, you know, we all wanted to make sure that a different perspective, one that wasn't just parroting the imperialist line on Cuba, was going to be provoked in the Capital District. And so a couple different organizations thought that it was a good idea to get together and hold a little rally in support of the people of Cuba against the blockade and U.S. attempts to undermine the revolution, and just offer that perspective opposed to the one that is this brutal Stalinist dictatorship in the Caribbean that is repressing its people and starving them on purpose and things of that sort.
Now, I notice I'm on the co-sponsor of Hudson Green Party, Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, Albany DSA, a Party for Socialism and Liberation, Albany. How does the blockade, you know, figure, you know, into these protests that, you know, have appeared in Cuba? And I will say, you know, I wish all the demonstrations that I organize that pull out similar numbers would receive such similar national attention from the American media. But how does the blockade actually figure into this situation?
Yeah. And just to add to that, too, I mean, on the same day of the Cuba protests, when they first began, 72 people were murdered in South Africa during protests. And Haiti held some of their largest demonstrations after their president was assassinated. So it really speaks to the interests of media when they talk about the Cuba protests, but several thousand historic protests, certainly, but comparatively not the largest that we've seen and not the largest that week. The way that the blockade plays in, it's crucial, and it's amazing how many reports don't even mention it, or when they do mention it, it's almost like in this disparaging way where they say it's an excuse for the dictatorship. The protests began as a response to shortages in food and goods, long queues and lines for commodities, basic necessities, and the Cuba blockade that the U.S. sponsors unilaterally, illegally, is the main piece, the main element that produces that shortage. Now, also COVID-19 has made this an issue, but it's also the Trump sanctions, the 240 Trump sanctions that were introduced between his presidency that Joe Biden promised to go back on, and he has not gone back on, that result in these shortages. There's nothing more cynical than this blockade and the way that it's portrayed in U.S. media as an excuse for all the issues that the government has. If it's not the blockade, then why don't we let it go and let the government fall on its own? We know it won't happen. The point of the blockade was to make the people upset enough that they would revolt against the communist dictatorship, as the U.S. says. Of course, it's a proletarian dictatorship that the people of Cuba have overwhelmingly supported and been unified by through the blockade's efforts to undermine this revolution.
Now, on a regular basis, basically every country on the planet, other than the United States and Israel, at the United Nations votes basically to condemn and to end the American blockade on Cuba. Why has the United Nations been so powerless to, you know, actually force the United States, what is this, 50 years now, to stop this blockade?
62 years, and you're absolutely right. It was just this month, I believe, might have been last month, that the UN for the 29th consecutive year voted almost unanimously to condemn the U.S. blockade. And why is it always the U.S. and Israel, these beacons of democracy, where they, you know, uphold racism in their laws, and then they say, oh, you know, there's a law that was passed that says that we can't do this anymore, so obviously we're not doing it anymore, you know, just ignoring all systemic critiques of it. It just speaks to the profanity of the entire thing. Why is the UN so powerless? The US is an instrumental player in the UN. The US is able to really bend the UN over its knee and force the UN into all of these weird, like the OPCW scandal with the Syria Duma gas attacks. The US made sure that the OPCW published the correct report, which was a doctored report. And so the same thing always happens in Cuba too, where the UN will say, or UNICEF will say, Cuba is a paradise for children because of the emphasis they put on maternal and child care. But the U.S. is always sure to make to have those, you know, human rights abuses documented at the front of the page. The U.N., what it's supposed to represent and what it does represent are completely different things. It's supposed to be the international community, but the international community is not supposed to be beholden to the U.S., which the U.N. is, and unfortunately, largely the international community, as we call it, is as well.
Now, a couple of weeks ago on our Peace Bucket, we talked about the Cuban situation with Medea Benjamin, one of the co-founders of Code Pink. And, you know, she had mentioned that a number of Cuban supporters, including a number of Cuban Americans, you know, were marching, I believe, from Miami up to D.C. to show their solidarity and particularly call for the end of the blockade. And other than, you know, following it on Facebook and other social media, this does, you know, has not been covered by the mainstream media, certainly in the United States. But are there other rallies, you know, similar to what's taking place in Albany, taking place elsewhere in the country?
Yes, there are. You know, it seems to be that the media, the U.S. media, would prefer to focus on these SOS Cuba rallies where the police in, DeSantis's Florida will you know, offer them guidance and escort protesters around. Meanwhile, DeSantis's government will repress BLM protesters and pass anti-riot laws and make it legal to hit them with their car. But the U.S. ignores all of that and wants to focus on these, you know, pro-intervention rallies in Cuba or in Florida about Cuba. And of course, doesn't focus on the protests just a couple days ago in Miami-Dade, where protesters were shouting, "Soy Fidel, I am Fidel, soy Fidelista, I am a follower of Fidel. I am Cuba, solidaridad con Cuba." You know, there are protests like this all over the country, and it's no coincidence that the U.S. and mainstream media doesn't want to give it any time, any broadcasting opportunity. I mean, you say one good thing about Cuba and they'll smear you to no end, just like they did Bernie Sanders. It's the freedom of speech, how we condemn Cuba for having no freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of protest. It's the same thing in the U.S., but it's a little bit worse because the U.S. is the imperialist core, and it prevents Cuba as well from offering its citizens the same rights, because it's so often the case that the U.S. is trying to undermine Cuba through, you know, financing protests through the National Endowment for Democracy and USAID, all of these emphases on freedom of expression through these hip hop groups that the NED sponsors. I mean, all of the protests that we see are not all of the protests there are. And there are plenty of them. There will be another one on the same day in Albany, sponsored by Party for Socialism and Liberation, to explain the disastrous blockade and why it's created this protest in Cuba in the first place.
So there's going to be a rally, Townsend Park, Cuba Support, Solidarity, Sunday, July 25th at 2 p.m. As in most countries, you know, it's often the young people, the teenagers, are most dissatisfied because they grow up and, you know, to be honest, the economic opportunities, you know, aren't particularly great. And certainly the American media has made a lot that, you know, I guess there's some hip hop artists who put out some, you know, songs saying, you know, sort of enough is enough. You know, what type of hope do you give to, you know, young people?
You know, young people, they lead the change. And it's often the case that the young people leading the change are at an oppositional standpoint to the government line. It's no coincidence that there are capitalists and Nazi punks in the USSR, because the USSR worked so hard to uproot those, what they considered negative ideals. I think what we would all consider quite negative ideals. And it's the same way in Cuba. You know, the younger population, they are of the first to experience consistent decline in their living standards. When Cuba came to be run by a revolutionary government, there was a lot of potential and excitement, and people felt the benefits. And since the USSR has collapsed, the special period in the 90s, and now this with the COVID crisis, the youth in Cuba, they have every right to be frustrated and demanding change. but it's the issue of how that is being positioned in the media that creates a sincere issue or concern in how the protests are commented on, how democracy is considered mm-hmm. to be.
I'm talking with Canyon Ryan, Capital District Socialist Party, this Sunday, July 25th, 2 p.m., Townsend Park in Albany. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. And that is another one of our weekly peak segments here on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the beautiful sanctuary for independent media in Troy, New York.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, warm regards, well, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on the social media at Media Sanctuary. Now, next up, Corrine Carey spoke with the organizers of a rally planned for July 25th in downtown Schenectady. The intent is to voice concerns over a proposed merger between Ellis Hospital and Trinity Health.
I'm speaking with members of the Schenectady Coalition for Healthcare Access about a rally that they're holding on Sunday, July 25th at 12:30 p.m. at Veterans Park in Schenectady. The rally, dubbed SOS or Save Our Services, aims to bring together community members to register concerns that they have about the merger between Ellis Medicine and Trinity Health. I spoke with one of the leaders of the coalition, Michelle Osterlich, a Schenectady County legislator. Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Corrine. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you tell me a bit about that rally and what's behind it?
The rally is, unfortunately, because we as a coalition and as a community have concerns about a hospital merger in our community that has risks to it. We've been trying to communicate our concerns directly to the administration, but we do feel it's falling on deaf ears. So we've decided to have a rally, get more people involved, have folks understand what those risks are, and hopefully just garner lots of attention and eyes on our hospital.
Tell me a bit about the merger and why it's happening.
We have an independent community hospital, and unfortunately, there just isn't much financial support in today's climate for independent community hospitals because the payer mix, frankly, isn't wonderful in rural or suburban, even suburban areas. That means that our local hospital long-term can't survive financially without merging with a larger healthcare system and taking advantage of a larger payer mix and efficiencies that come along, hopefully, in a larger system.
If something needs to be done to make sure that the hospital in Schenectady is viable, what are the alternatives? What is your group calling for?
So our group is not calling for stopping the merger, unfortunately. That's just not on the table. We're not questioning the choice necessarily of the partner. So our local hospital's name is Ellis Medicine, and the organization that's gobbling it up is Trinity Health, which is a multi-state healthcare system headquartered in Michigan. We're asking the administration to work harder in negotiating with Trinity Health issues that are really, really critical locally to get them in writing and make them part of this partnership agreement.
What is it about Trinity Health and the way that they're going about the merger that concerns you?
Trinity Health is a 90 hospital healthcare system. It's incredibly large, and they are affiliated with the Catholic Church. Knowing what we know about how Trinity Health operates, we know that cuts are coming to our healthcare services. We know that for financial reasons, for policy-based reasons, that we know there are certain choices we're not going to have in Schenectady County at our local hospital because of this partner. That's what we're most concerned about, are these cuts. And when we look at the administration, we're not hearing much. And it's that deafening silence that we're most worried about. So we want answers. We want to know what they're trying to negotiate. We want to make sure that when they are at the table, They're working hard to preserve services, services that we've already gotten word or we can expect that will be cut with this merger.
So a rally is a pretty big deal, but has the relationship between the community and the hospital always been contentious? What has the relationship been between the hospital and the community?
Our community has supported Ellis Medicine through many, many changes over the years. Our residents have volunteered like countless hours at the hospital. Our donors have supported many capital fund drives and other fundraising activities. So our community has been incredibly supportive of Ellis Medicine. They even merged about eight or nine years ago with two other local hospitals. It was a huge transition, and a lot of the folks employed there at those other two hospitals are now employed with Ellis Medicine. So our friends and neighbors work there, our friends and neighbors volunteer there, and our friends and neighbors give a lot of money to support our local hospital. So it's really a cornerstone institution. It's a large employer, and it's our only community hospital. So we rely on it, certainly through the pandemic, we relied on it. They haven't, in recent years, been very communicative. They have not been very enmeshed in our community. So there are some, I think, concerns about a general lack of communication with our community over the years, more recently. But what's playing out now is unique. The fact that they are going through this incredible watershed moment without getting community input is just disturbing. We're in a position that we're just saying, can we talk? Tell us what's going on. It's frustrating. I hope that it doesn't become out and out oppositional.
I spoke with Nikita Hardy, a maternal health and birth justice advocate and Schenectady community member. Nikita, why is it important, do you think, for the community to gather for this rally?
So that Ellis can see that the community is concerned and to get their voices heard. A lot of people in the community still to this day are not aware of what is happening right now in our backyards. And this rally is an opportunity for us to show Ellis that this isn't okay and that Ellis needs to take a step back and bring the community in for this very crucial conversation.
What concerns you about the proposed merger?
I have a bunch of concerns, but the primary ones I have are for the marginalized communities that would be impacted by the changes that will be implemented. Some of the changes that have already been implemented as a policy person and just even as a birth worker, knowing that a lot of times when decisions are made, impact studies, disparity studies are not done. And Ellis isn't starting on the right foot by not bringing the community in from the very beginning.
Are there services that you're particularly interested in that you think will be in jeopardy if this merger proceeds the way it looks like it's going to?
Yes, tubal ligations, abortion services, contraception, fertilization, surrogacy, gender affirming cares, those are real core services connected to one's person, gender, and experiences. And I'm also concerned about end of life care and the limits that people will have when it comes to that end point where their life is about to end. Being able to choose how they leave this earth and have those limited options is a major concern. Those are key ones that come from choices that we make as individuals that this merger would put in jeopardy and take away. You know, in the work that I've done, the work that I do in the community as a doula, in my work as a public administrator, as a concerned community member myself, we'll have a good chunk of the population that won't be able to go elsewhere to receive these services, or they'll be facing a timeline that will not allow them to be able to navigate the already cumbersome system that we have. The fact that Ellis isn't taking this into consideration just begs the question why, and not even being flexible with it, not even being open. When we talk about well woman care, we have to take into consideration other factors that would make these changes exponentially worse. We already have a high maternal mortality and morbidity rate, not only in New York State, but especially in Schenectady. It's irresponsible not to take this into consideration. How are we fighting for people and fighting for us to heal and decrease those rates when changes like this are happening in our community? It's just baffling. Ellis is a part of the community. They're just not acting like it. Where is the human part of medicine? You're not just treating bodies, Ellis, you're treating people. And if you're not keeping the people in mind, what are you keeping in mind? Where are these decisions being led from? Business? Yes, business is important. However, when it comes to a point where a business decision takes away quality of someone's life and how they want to live their life, then it has to be reevaluated.
I also spoke with Arthur Butler, the executive director of Schenectady County's Human Rights Commission and one of the organizers of the rally. What do you hope that the administrators of the hospital hear from the rally?
Well, I hope that they hear that we're unified and that we're a community that they just can't push around or roll over or not see that we're here and that we matter and that our health care matter and that our lives matter and decisions that they make should matter as much as we believe that we matter.
And that was Corinne Carey speaking about the rally plan for July 25th in downtown Schenectady, voicing concern over the proposed merger between Ellis Hospital and Trinity Health. And we'll be covering more of that event. And that
and we'll have also the July 25th rally with Cuba on the same day.
Absolutely. So you're all busy that day, I guess. Next up, Willie Terry interviewed Troy Snug, Should Never Use Guns, that's S-N-U-G, Snug Outreach organizers and staff, Wendy Shepherd, Shadisa Wheeler, Rahim, Tawana Scott, and James Chestnut about their recent barbecue and the work to stop gun violence in Troy.
This is Willie Terry, your Army Labor Correspondent, here in Troy at the Troy Snug Pop-Out Balloon Cookout Water Balloon Fight. And I'm here on 6th Ave, all 6th Ave, yeah. And it looked like they just had the water fight. I'm glad I missed it.
You are glad you missed it.
Glad, just because you got wet.
Right. And I'm here with,
Intern Program Manager for Troy Snug, James Chestnut.
Raheem Brown, Senior Outreach Worker.
Tawana Scott, Outreach Worker.
Sadeja Wheeler, Case Manager.
Wendy Shepherd, Social Worker.
And tell me some about the event, why you had this event today and what was the purpose?
Well, we felt like it was a good time with all the violence going on right now in the community to bring all the people out, to bring the kids out, to show them that, you know, we stay here for support and just let everybody know we're here and offer our services and things of that nature.
And what is Snug?
Snug is an anti-gun violence program. Snug stands for Should Never Use Guns. It's gun spelled backwards.
And where is Snug located in Troy?
We're located at 3100 6th Avenue in Troy. We also work to reduce the gun violence, and we mediate conflicts and work with the highest risk individual that's at risk of being a shooter or being shot at.
Yeah. All right. And your name is again?
Sadeja Wheeler.
And Sadeja, you got Snug Outreach. What kind of outreach do you do?
I'm the case manager, so I help with the participants that we have in. So if they need employment, housing, or any services overall, I'm there to help them with that. And I also help and support my team.
A great deal.
A great deal.
If it wasn't for her, today would have been real hard. I just want to say that.
Oh, okay. And you'll tell me your name is again?
Wendy Shepherd.
And Wendy, you're the counselor?
Yes, I'm the social worker.
The social worker, okay. Mm-hmm. And what do you do?
So my job is to support the outreach team and the participants. We do counseling services as well as help them with OVS victim services that they may need at the time. So I'm here to support my outreach workers, my case manager, and the rest of the team.
So all of y'all are in Troy?
Yes.
The Troy brand?
We're all in cahoots. We're all together.
Oh, okay. So how do you support yourself? It's not just an independent group, or it's supported by some organization?
No, we're part of Trinity Alliance. Trinity Alliance is our the agency that we work for, and Snug is up under them. And our funding is through OVS, so Office of Victim Services.
And DCJS.
And DCJS.
And how many chapters are there in Snug? Is there one in Schenectady?
It's 13. It's
13, right?
It's 12.
Offices.
It's 12. It's
12.
Yonkers, Mohaven, Newburgh,
Syracuse.
Buffalo, Syracuse, Buffalo,
Rochester, Poughkeepsie, Newburgh,
The Bronx,
Mount Vernon,
Jacoby Hospital,
Long Island,
Wyandotte,
Hempstead,
Mount Vernon, Albany.
Albany.
Yeah. So we have two chapters between Troy and Albany. So it's Albany 518 Snug and about LLTY, Troy Snug. So LLTY is Leaders Leading Troy Youth.
Now, you know, in the news lately, there's been a lot of reports. They say violence is in the uptake all over, especially gun violence. And there's a lot of things going on in New York City, per se, and some of the other major cities like Chicago. So how effective have y'all program been?
Well, we've been very, very effective because, like we said, we deal with the highest risk in the community. So we have our hands on those guys and those kids personally. So we're able to slow a lot of things down before they happen. We're in prevention, early prevention. Things still happen, but we're able to reach out to the ones that most people can't reach out to. We can get to those kids. And that's how we're able to slow things down.
We're considered credible messengers. You know, some of the participants we dealt with, we were once the participants ourselves, meaning we were once in the streets ourselves. So it was easy to relate to them and get to them. And they, you know, they have a better understanding when we talk to them compared to somebody coming with a tie and a suit. They can't relate. You know, it's like, who's this guy? So that's all it is. It's about, you know, being the credibility in who you are.
Well said.
And yeah, most of all, you got to talk their language sometimes as well to really get to them, for them to gain your trust.
And this is our first female in five
years. Yeah, I'm the first female for Troy Snug.
No. Actually, she's the first female.
Well, outreach. She's the first outreach worker.
She's the first female.
I'm the first female hired at the site.
So they have we have an outreach team and we have a social work team. So our case manager and social worker are on the social work team, and this is our outreach team, and together we make up that Troy Snug office.
Yeah, wow. Now, what about law enforcement? Do they work with y'all? Do they, you have any relationship?
Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all?
No, we want to be credible. Think about it. Right. How can we work with law enforcement dealing with high-risk individuals that's in the street or shoot or at-risk of getting shot? Think about it. It don't make no sense.
Well, you know you got to ask that question because of Black Lives Matter.
Nah, we know police
over
there.
They give us information, but we cannot give them information.
And we won't help them. We will not work with them to get what they need.
They'll let us know things in nature, like when it's a shooting, when certain areas are heavily populated with certain things. That's the far as that goes. Okay. That's it.
So what are some of the areas you're working on in Troy?
With some of the areas?
Areas, yeah.
We got, okay.
We have a target area, which is Zone C, Zone B, and Zone A, which stretch from, was it 101st, all the way down to Federal.
Yeah.
So from 100, the first street down in the Burg, going this way, all the way down to Federal, we got three different zones. That's how we break it up.
We also go outside our target areas. Like South Troy has a lot of issues, we go down there. Wherever there's issues we in Troy, we kind of go to that area and, you know, and relate to the, get to the community and let them know that we're here for our, you know, provide our services as well.
And so most times when we're out canvassing, we do get a lot of information from the community. They let us know what's going on, who's doing what, and we try to take it from there.
So you do a lot of work going out in the community.
Oh, yeah, everything is outside.
Outreach. We're street outreach.
Everything
street
is outside, outreach. Yes.
So is there any other program that y'all thinking about, you know, based on doing outreach? Programs, any other
so
programs.
We have
like working with the
we come together with we have like enrolls community partners that we can like, come together
so
with
Team
coordinate
Hero,
with
Unity House, all these other entities in Troy, we deal with most of them.
So sometimes we get referrals for our program, and sometimes the person, whoever's coming to our program, doesn't fit our description. So then we will find another program for them. Maybe Team Hero will work for them. You got Step It Up, this is Kevin Pryor's
Troy
program,
Look.
Troy Look.
Face Card.
So we'll find another program for them. We got Youth Build. Because sometimes, you know, you might meet the criteria for our program, because our program is gun violence.
Mm-hmm. So are y'all in school? Do you go into like Troy High and talk
yes,
to
we're
people?
Oh,
we're all in the schools, yeah.
We're definitely
school
in the schools.
12, Troy High, Lansingburg. When school's in, we usually go outside the schools after, you know, greet the kids, let them know who we are and things of that nature. We stop stuff at schools, too.
Yeah, and then when you go pick up some of your participants at schools, you get to talk to, like, the principals, their teachers. You know, you get a rapport with their teachers and everything.
Let me ask you a question, too. Now, you have a community out here. Is there anything people in the community could do to kind of help y'all? You know, they're saying, well, Snug is out there, well, what could we do to...
They honestly, like you said, they honestly do help us. Honestly, when it's a shooting, somebody will call one of us immediately.
Yeah.
And we'll know about it, and we, you know, we conjure up, we get together, and we make a plan and get to that area. Confidential, yeah.
I said, so any help they're giving us is confidential. Nobody's going to know that you gave us the help for it. You could also help by coming to volunteer. Come out and support the events. Right. Talk to the other youth that's in the community. Get to know your neighbors.
Well, what I maybe thought about is that you maybe need help to tell these politicians that y'all are access to the community and that we need y'all.
Right.
You know, you need people to, hey, don't mess with them.
Yeah. Right. I think we got our footprint out here now.
Yeah, yeah.
We got a heavy footprint.
Right. Like, we was out here yesterday, me and SOW Brown, and the community, like, you know, y'all doing a good job coming out. You know, we handed out the flyers. Even the senior citizens came over here today, and even though it's for like a youth thing, but it was for the community.
Right.
So, and they all came and participated, and a lot of them are grateful when they see us walking around.
And everything we do is free.
Free.
Free food,
free.
Everything is free. So you can let the people know, always come out to our events, everything is free. Yeah.
So do you have plan to have more events before the summer?
Sure.
Told you
sure.
Every month we have a participant event and a community event. We're supposed to be having a participant event this Friday.
What's the participant event?
So basically, we found out what they want to do and we take them somewhere. It could be a water park. We took them to football, NFL football games before, baseball games, whatever they want to do. It's like a reward incentive to them, something to look forward to, take them out, you know, their norm, which is this, so they can see something different and experience something different.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, that's basically my question, but I just want to say, is there anything else that y'all think that people should know about Snug?
Snug love.
Snug love.
Snug love.
Snug
love.
Snug love.
We're here for the community.
And also, you don't have to be a victim to literally come get services.
Right.
You don't have to be somebody that's, you know, a shooter or risk of being shot. If you just need help, you can also come get help. So we open to everybody.
How could one get in touch with Snug? So what's your website or your telephone number?
Well, you can reach us at 518-203-7029, or you can follow us on Instagram at LLTY_snug, or Facebook at LLTY_snug.
Thank y'all. Thank you, Snug. Thank
y'all. So that was another Roman Labor correspondent, Willie Terry special. Snug stands for should never use guns. And that was talking to outreach workers, Wendy Shepherd, Sadeja Wheeler, Raheem Tawana Scott, and James Chestnut.
So next up, part two of an interview Dulcinea Diggs was speaking with Jada Robinson, a young black female fighter, about her return to the Junior Olympics.
Hello, this is HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for WOOC 105.3 FM, and today I'm speaking with returning guest Jada Robinson. Last time we spoke, she touched upon her experiences with going to the 2019 Junior Olympics. Today she is here to discuss her return to the ring. This time she is headed to the 2021 Junior Olympics. Please welcome my guest, Jada Robinson. How are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Jada, please tell me, what have you been up to since the last time we spoke?
I've been training. I've just been staying in the gym trying to get things back on track from, you know, being on shutdown and everything. And my uncle and trainer sent me a bunch, just opened this gym in Grizzle Heights in Troy. And now what we've been doing is building, you know, taking kids off the street and doing what we have to do.
Okay, and how has it been being back in your favorite boxing studio?
It's been great. It's my sport. Like, I feel like once I first walked into the Albany Quailshie Boxing Gym, it just clicked with me. And ever since then, it's just been something that I love to do that I'm going to continue doing.
Okay. And what did you miss most about being in the ring?
I definitely miss the traveling, because, like, me and what I do, I don't really do local fights. So I'm usually really out of town. I meet new people. I meet new gyms. So I just really miss the traveling. I really miss how everything was before, you know, the mask and the, you know, 6 feet apart and stuff like that.
Okay, definitely. And can you tell my audience, what are some of the qualifications to make the Junior Olympics?
Well, one, you have to be an open fighter, which means you have to have 5 or more fights. 2, you have to go through a semi of fights before the Junior Olympics, because of the type of fight it is. It's a big tournament where, you know, anybody from anywhere can come, you know, any fighter from anywhere. So you have to go through that. You have to be an open fighter. Other than that, you have to be on weight, and you'll see what happens when you get there.
Okay. And how long have you trained for this moment?
I've been training since, I've been training since COVID. So I've been training at home. And then once my uncle opened the gym, I've been training here. So I work out twice a day. So I come to the gym, then I go home and train. So I just been trying to, you know, work on myself, you know, so that I can be able to, what I'm used to doing after the whole shutting down and everything.
Give the best version of you.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely. And when did your uncle reopen the gym?
Back in December. So we've been here for a while. All we've been trying to do is, you know, have more people coming, have more kids coming, because, you know, a lot of kids are doing things that, you know, they ain't got no business doing. A lot of kids are on the street or, you know, getting hurt and stuff. But he definitely opened a gym up to the public to where, you know, you can come. You ain't even gotta, you know, take this work serious. You can come, you can learn, you can train, socialize, anything.
Okay. And how are you doing your part as a young woman and getting kids off the street?
I know I inspire, you know, all ages and all kids and stuff like that, but I definitely look at the girls first, because it's like, you know, not every girl has to be a hairstylist or a makeup artist or, you know, so I feel like once you come in here, and like I said, or once you go into, you know, any other sport, once you see it and once it clicks with you, then I feel like, you know, that's what you want to do.
Definitely. I agree with that. You know, there are so many careers out here. Yeah. And I feel that sometimes, I don't want to say it's settling, but I feel that because it was put in our face, mm-hmm. it's what we think we should do.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's so many other careers that need women, especially women of color. Now, what is your favorite position to use when you are in the ring?
That's like the question I had got asked when they were like, you know, what's your favorite punch? I feel like every position is my favorite position because I know how to use them. I use them well, and, you know, they benefit me for, you know, whatever opponent I'm fighting. And there's different positions for, like, if there's someone taller than me or if there's someone my height. From there, I know what position to use, you know, because my trainer, you know, we're trained to do that. We're trained to know what skill to use with what particular fighter. We're trained to learn the fighter at first and then, you know, then take that position. So I definitely think that every position I use is my favorite position.
All right. What is a skill you need to work on in the ring?
I definitely need to work on getting on the inside and opening up, because, like, people taller than me, I have a tendency of, like, you know, fighting them, boxing them, and then getting on the inside and then trying to get out again. Instead of getting on the inside and opening up and throwing punches to the body and to the head, I usually just throw to the head, get inside, and then come back out, instead of, you know, using my advantage to where I am in the ring to open up and, you know, gain more points. But I've been working on it.
Is that because you get a little nervous, or what is causing you to do that position?
Well, it is nervousness, but I get nervous, you know, every fight, but not nervous because I think I'm a loser or anything, but nervous because I want to win, nervous because I'm anxious. So I definitely think just with that is, I don't like being hit. So with that, it's just like, oh yeah. But then again, like I said, I get in there and I like freeze up. I like pose, you know, so I definitely been working on it though.
Okay. And how do you get over losing a match?
Oh, well, I basically just look back on, you know, my mistakes or what I didn't do, what I should have done. And other than that, I just come back in the gym and I work on it. Most fighters, they shut down or, you know, do whatever. But me, I don't shut down. I give my sportsmanship. I give the hugs. I say thank you and stuff like that. Because all it is opportunity, you know. So, yeah, I give my thank yous. And I just get back in the gym and work on what I didn't do or what I should have done in the fight I lost.
Okay, I like that. That's right. Always looking for improvements. Okay, and now, as we all know, the pandemic made millions of businesses, organizations, schools, etc., shut down. What has the pandemic taught you about life as a young woman? Because, you know, you are experiencing this from a completely different age as opposed to an adult. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tell me what it was like for you.
I feel like it was a bumpy road for everybody, for the world, because, like, we went from going into school to being on computers. We went from being on computers, you know, as things started to ease up, we went from being on the computers to going back into school for a couple of days, and then staying home on the computers for a couple of days. I feel like it was just like a lesson learned. It definitely tested our patience and, you know, what we do outside of work and stuff like that, especially not working. And then your feeling comes in where it's like, I want to work, you know, from when you go to work every day and it's like, I don't want to go to work today, you know. So I feel like it definitely tested our patience. Then, like, with us, the kids who are still in school, I don't like going to school, but then it's like, yo, I want to go to school, you know. So that's how I was like, yo, I do not feel like getting up for school. And then as we had to do it on the computers. I'm like, I miss school. I miss my friends. Oh my gosh. But other than that, like I said, I definitely think it did, you know, test our patience. I think it did help us realize, you know, a few things that, you know, something like that could just stop everything, and mm-hmm. we have to be prepared for it. And we're not used to something like that, so we weren't prepared. But I feel like, if God forbid, if that was to ever happen again, we just know, you know,
exactly what to do this time, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
definitely, definitely. Okay, and all the restrictions with COVID-19 are slowly letting up. Are there any COVID guidelines you had or have to follow in order to be a contestant?
I believe that we have to get tested. I don't think we have to get vaccinated yet, but mm-hmm. I do know that we would have to get tested, you know, before our fights and everything. I do know that the referees and our coaches have to wear masks, mm-hmm. and so do we, except for when we're fighting and stuff like that. But that's pretty much it. I don't think the 6 feet thing is going to work, because, like, at those tournaments, there's so many kids, and it's like,
They don't have to get tested. They have to just wear the mask.
Okay, and then what about the capacity limit? Is there a capacity limit for this?
No. You're looking at about 1,800 to 2,000 kids that are participating, that are actually going to be fighting. You know, of course, some will fall off, some will disqualify, mm-hmm. Some will walk over, you know, because there's no opponent to fight, or the opponent dropped off. And so we're very excited.
Okay, definitely. Okay, and when is your next local event? Because, you know, we want to see you out here too. You know, we can't all go flying out with you. So when is your next big event out here?
The most local events that we usually have are like an event in Schenectady, or after Schenectady, the closest is Rochester. But other than that, all our events are usually out of town. But that's the thing, like, usually just the big events are out of town. The regular mm-hmm. boxing matches, the regular sparring matches and stuff like that are, you know, in the city or at Swinburne in Albany. But other than that, yeah, usually all our big fights and tournaments and, you know, more than 3 day fights and stuff like that are out of town.
Do you have a date for the one in Schenectady, or is it up in the air?
July 24th. That's in Rochester though.
Okay. All right. And what was the last book you read? Did you read any books during this pandemic?
The last one I did read The Hate U Give, and I also saw the
really?
Movie. Yeah. And that book, it really just inspired me to see the whole movie and book focus around a black person's perspective, a black lady's perspective, a black family perspective, actually, mm-hmm. you know. It definitely opened my eyes to a lot of things, especially with what's been going on through the pandemic with, you know, police officers killing black people and innocent black people being killed or shot at or anything. It definitely opened my eyes to that. And it's like, for what though? You know, that's really what it made me question.
Okay. Now, I know you've worked closely with Roy Jones Jr. Mm-hmm. as well as his wife, but who is your favorite boxer? Who is your boxing hero?
My boxing hero is Roy Jones Jr.
Really?
But yes, but if you're talking about, like, other than him, then Clarissa Shields, I definitely look up to her because she's doing a lot in the boxing industry for the black females. So I definitely do look up to her in so many ways, from her boxing, from her now joining UFC. She's just, you know, she's everywhere. She's doing everything she can, and she's just doing a lot for us. So I really appreciate that.
Definitely. Okay, and one final question. How can the public reach you and see more of what you do?
On Facebook at Jada's World, on Instagram at Jada's Hands.
Okay, do you have any final words?
Just, you know, just do you. Stay on your grind and do what you have to do to make sure that you're successful.
Okay, Jada Robinson, well, I want to thank you so much for sitting down with me for this interview. And this has been HM correspondent Dulcinea Diggs for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And that was part two of the interview with Jada Robinson. If you want to find part one, you can go to our website at mediasanctuary.org. Look down at the bottom for stories.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Conliff.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Our engineer is a spectacular senior Vasila Hickey.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories or through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. And that's it, folks. Thanks for tuning in.